Support comes from Hampton Roads Community Foundation, partnering with donors from all walks of life to improve Southeastern Virginia through grants, scholarships, and leadership initiatives. Learn more at hamptonroadscf.org.
Hello, everyone. I'm Barbara Ham Lee. This year's July 4th celebration was special, commemorating the 250th anniversary of the signing of the Declaration of Independence. In a time fraught with political and cultural dissent, the holiday was a chance for all Americans to come together and acknowledge that despite our differences, democracy still stands. Yet politics prevailed, even in the planning of events. America 250 or Freedom 250, anyone? Up next on Another View, how historians of the future might talk about America and democracy at the 250-year mark. That's next on Another View, right after this national, regional, and local news from NPR and WHRO News.
Discussing today's topics from an African-American perspective, this is Another View.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Another View. I'm Barbara Ham Lee. I'm back from vacation. Thank you to Lisa Godley and the rest of the Another View crew for holding things down while I took some time off, celebrated my birthday, and hung out for the holiday, and it was great. But I'm happy to be back with you, audience, and thank you so much for tuning in today. Of course, I have to start with something major happening in our community, and that is the Hampton Storytelling Festival. We've had Jay Johnson and other storytellers on our show on several occasions. It is always a great time. It is happening July 17 through 19, so that's next week, in Hampton, and it is free for all ages. All of the programs will be held at the American Theater, which is on 125 East Mellon Street in Hampton, and you can find out who's showing up and the types of stories they're going to be telling and so forth at hamptonstorytelling.art. HamptonStorytelling.art. And one of the major culminations is the a story feast, a smorgasbord for the ears, an elegant evening of dining and stories. That's going to happen on July 18th, that Saturday, from 6 to 9 p.m. at the Hampton Yacht Club. And if you want more information about that particular event, call 757-725-1398. So going out, support them. They tell great stories, and it's a lovely time for everyone in the family. So when historians talk about the future, when historians of the future talk about America at age 250, what will their perspective be? Will they talk about nationwide celebrations that brought together people of all races and cultures? Or will the focus be on the photo that went viral of a Black woman seated, unmasked, on a DC Metro train surrounded by white supremacists en masse? Or will they talk about both? Here with some thoughts on how America might be portrayed is internationally renowned historian Dr. Cassandra Newby-Alexander. Hi, Cassandra.
Hello, Barbara. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you for being here today. And joining us by phone is constitutional law scholar Dr. Vania Blakelock. And Vania, congratulations on the doctor.
Thank you.
Last time she was on our show, she was working on her doctorate, and I think you told me you did your dissertation the week after you were a guest on our show, right?
Yep, I defended right after. Yep.
Fantastic. That is fantastic.
Congratulations. Thank you.
So I'm going to ask that question. Cassandra, I'll start with you, Cassandra. What will the perspective, if you were a historian 50 years from now, 30 years from now, what would you say about what's happening in America today?
I think that historians in the future are going to have a very unique perspective, much like the perspective that we have when we're looking back on the 1990s or even the going further back, the 1980s. There will be access to a lot more documents. I think that people will probably see this period of Trump as a period similar to the turn of the 20th century, where there were so many people looking backward and trying to recreate a past that really didn't exist and fill the nation with a lot of mythologies, a lot of stereotypes, and a lot of lies about who we really are. And so I'm not too sure that historians in the future will be that kind to, as they analyze this period in American history. Huh,
interesting. From a law perspective, Vania, what do you think the people, the law professors, the law historians of the future will say about what's happened, especially in light of all the changes with the Supreme Court?
Yeah, that's a really great question. And actually, when I was thinking about this question, I kept coming back to this sentence that Justice Jackson says in the recent Trump v. Barber decision in her concurrence. And she's talking about remembering history. And she says, and this is a quote, she says, "The distortion of historical facts, retellings that reimagine and repurpose past events to lend credence to misbegotten aims may be an even greater threat than how we remember history," basically. And so I wonder if we have to ask not only how will historians remember the 250th, but also whether those rememberings can be true. Like, will they be true? How will they be true? Because not only will people have more information, we will have more, doctored information. There will be AI documents that people might think are true that aren't true. So that is, I think that'll be a new challenge for historians also, just kind of weaving between what is right and what is correct and what is not correct.
And what is not correct. So the two different versions of the July 4th celebration, to me, was an excellent kind of a snapshot of what's happening in the country today. So from a historical perspective, what do you think will happen with that? Will one outweigh the other in terms of how people in the future kind of look at us now?
You know, for as long as America has been America, there have been two Americas. There's been the privileged America that weaves its own story and documented that story in legal precedents, legal cases, laws, and so forth, and in their family histories. And then there's been always a real story, the actual story, the one that tells the broader picture, but you have to use more than just printed documents. You have to look at the culture. You have to look at newspapers, and you have to look at archaeological material, and you have to look at oral accounts. You have to look at images, whether those images were painted or, of course, the images using any kind of technology, whether it's cameras on right. your phone or, the old-fashioned cameras. But it's a wider variety of ways that you approach. When I at 50 billion years ago, when I was going through my graduate school education, most of the historians who were training me were very much document oriented, the very traditional way, the very traditional approach. But because I was focused on African American history, I was in the Blassing Game school of thought that you had to go further than that. For example, with our Soul Down River project, the documents that list all the people who were sold in from the Norfolk Harbor to New Orleans slave market, mm-hmm. none of the people's names were listed. And we know some of the names of the people, but it wasn't in the ship manifest. We had to go to the probate records and the sale records and a whole bunch of other records that in New Orleans were actually in French. To uncover the names of the people, the descriptors of those individuals, the fact that that families were separated, that children were taken from their parents, that husbands and wives were torn apart. And that helped us to uncover some of the information. There's a lot more that we're uncovering, but you cannot just go by one source or just the who is writing down what. We found that out when we were looking at 1619 and what actually happened with the 32 to 35 people who were brought here from the Kingdom of Ndongo. And we know that the corporation that brought them here, the Virginia Company of London, was hiding what they were actually doing. They tampered with their very records and falsified some information. And then the person, the secretary who was writing it, actually alluded to that in the records. And so previous historians just kind of ignored that information. But going back, you find these trails, these clues, because historians have to first and foremost be detectives. And you cannot trust any one source as your single source of information. And it is very true in this AI world, and I caution my students all the time about using AI because AI is selective in what it looks at. It does not go into books and articles. It only goes, you know, basically looks at what is on a website. And then they get that wrong. I asked the question, you know, how many black men served aboard European ships during the colonial and antebellum period? And AI told me none. And I know that's a lie. But because their source material was limited, they give wrong, it gives wrong information all the time. Historians are quite aware of that. And so we're trained not to trust anything, you know. Verify before you even jump to a conclusion.
Is there a number of that I know in journalism, for example, at least when I was coming up, when I was younger journalist, you always had to have at least three sources to verify the same information before you could say, yes, this is factual enough for us to go on air with. Is there a number in the historian world that...
It's not really a number. It is simply trying to find as much information
as you can
and seeing where it crosses, because there are times when there is only one source.
Yeah.
But then you have to question, what is the motivation of the source in writing this down or in telling this story? And I certainly found that to be true in writing the book about First Baptist Church of Williamsburg. There were people who were wanting to feel like they were helping the folks at First Baptist, and therefore they unintentionally or maybe intentionally erased the agency of the people in that church and how they were very much involved in helping to create their own destiny.
And that new book will be coming out soon as part of the Let Freedom Ring Foundation, of which I serve on the board. So I have to be in all full disclosure, but we are so excited to have that history written there. Vania, let me ask you this, or let me tell you a story. When the Supreme Court came out with the decision on Louisiana versus Callis, it was a show day for us. And so I was reading different articles about the decision, and I went to AI and I said, make this make sense to me, not in legalese. And the very first line was, this is a great thing for black people.
Oh no.
Exactly. And I was so glad that I had a perspective, enough of a knowledge to know that that was wrong. And then it went on to explain about how the drawing of the maps would be beneficial to black people, et cetera, et cetera. And it was just shocking to me how wrong it was.
So I in my classes, I similarly even encourage students not to use AI, not because it can't be helpful, it can, but the it's designed to confirm what you already are thinking, too. So a lot of times students will ask it questions, and it will take leading. It will be led through that. But I also think that there's something more insidious about the fact that it is drawing from what's on the internet. So, for example, not Louisiana v. Kalis, but Trump v. Barbara, you know, the mm-hmm. main majority opinion of that case is only 20 pages. Justice Thomas's dissent is 96 pages. So, you know, if you're asking an AI, a language model, it has more material from the dissent than it does from the majority opinion. And so it's very easy to misconstrue, right, what the point of the decision is. So sorry, I interrupted you from your story.
No, you're fine. That's exactly what I was looking for in terms of how do you then decide or teach future historians that they've got to keep digging, just like you guys keep digging. Yeah.
Well, you know, historians looking at these cases, you know, my head explodes every time many of the conservatives on the Supreme Court start justifying their racism. It reminds me so much of all of the justifications, and this is what I instruct my students, all the justifications for slavery. There were volumes and volumes. You look at Thomas Jefferson's Notes on Virginia, where he spends so much time trying to explain away his racism and his decision to remain a slaveholder, knowing that he was wrong in what he was doing by even saying that black people weren't human. They were some hybrid species of an original African woman and an orangutan. And I'm still trying to figure out, how did this orangutan, who's from Asia, come over to Africa and have sex with an actual human being and produce black people? And so, you know, these leaps of logic are always... And I remind my students, if you want to know when someone is splaining, meaning they're trying to justify a lie, they take a long time to say
it. They take a long time, yep.
They come up with all kinds of I call it verbal diarrhea, where they just start talking and talking, these threads that make no sense, that are threads to nowhere, and completely confuses you, so that by the time you get to the end, you ask the question, so what was your point again? Because you get lost in the volume
of what they're talking about.
Information. And these cases are simple. The 14th Amendment, I keep hearing people say it over and over and over again, and it's still a lie. The 14th Amendment was not just written to restore the rights of human beings who had been formerly enslaved as citizens. Because if you were enslaved, you were not seen as a citizen. This was for freeborn people. The Dred Scott decision did not just strip enslaved people of their humanity. They stripped all black people of their humanity because they used the word Negro in that case. And that included both free blacks as well as those who were enslaved. So the 14th Amendment was restoring what was seen as a given, which is that anybody who was free and in this country was considered a citizen.
And Barbara,
go ahead.
I was just going to say really quick that it is also, in terms of remembering this moment and thinking about this moment with the court, one thing that is really fascinating is that this is a court that, at least verbally, is very concerned with history. And so in every case, from the gun rights cases to the birthright citizenship, to voting rights, you have the conservatives and the progressives increasingly utilizing what a lot of people like to call lawyer history, where people not trained to be historians are engaging in historical analysis and in a way that becomes the law. It becomes enshrined. And so that, in some ways, I think it's more dangerous and more important for legal historians to be vocal about the fact that this is not historical analysis as it is done by experts, by trained historians, because that's what's happening. You have someone, I talked about this the last time I was there, you have conservative justices saying, this is what the history says, thus this is the conclusion we're drawing from it, And then that becomes the law that they rely on two cases down the line. So like Justice Alito and the Kalis decision basically sketches out this strong history of us being colorblind, but then he's citing cases from 2020 and the future. So it's just very interesting who gets to be the kind of dictator of history and how we have to be weary of the court taking on that role.
Now, do you remember, before I come back to you, Cassandra, Vania, do you remember any other times in past law history or legal history where this has been the case? In other words, where somebody was interpreting history to fit what they were trying to accomplish?
I would argue that history has always mattered in every decision. Even, you know, Dred Scott's been in the news a lot because of the birthright citizenship case. And Chief Justice Taney is relying on his history and particularly the founding, right? He spends a lot of time in Dred Scott discussing what the founders intended, what the founders thought all men being created equal meant, and how that excluded Black people because it had to, right? Because they weren't liars. And that would have made them liars. And so I would say that history has always been relevant, but it's not until post-Brown, post-Reagan, where originalism is on the rise. And for those who don't know, originalism is a type of constitutional interpretation that conservative justices tend to subscribe to, which argue that the Constitution provisions have an original meaning that can't be changed except for by amendment. And so once that starts to become the standard approach to interpretation, if something has an original meaning, you have to look backwards to find it. By definition, it is a theory that looks backwards. So history is prioritized now as an exclusive way to interpret the Constitution, when before I think it was just one of the many tools. So very famously, Chief Justice Warren in Brown v. Board, he says, you know, he actually, when asking the NAACP, when they were drawing the brief, he very famously tells them to go back and give him the history about how the Reconstruction Congress, whether they would have thought about desegregation when they were drafting the 14th Amendment. And what happens is they find that it's actually inconclusive, or on the other hand, they were totally cool with segregation. And because the court didn't want to rule that way, Chief Justice Warren famously says, we can't turn back the clock. And so I think that we are in a new moment because history is the only way of interpreting the Constitution. And there are dangers to that and consequences usually for marginalized people, because if you want an inclusive America, you can't look backwards. Yeah. Our history doesn't bode well for inclusivity. You have to look forward.
757-440-2665 or 1-800-940-2240 are the numbers to call to join our conversation. What do you think about the future and how America will be viewed going forward? Give us a call. Let's talk. 757-440-2665 or 1-800-940-2240. From both of your perspectives, and I'll start with you, Cassandra, is democracy safe?
Wow, that's a loaded question. Is democracy safe? So I believe that people have to, first of all, believe in rule of law. And as long as you believe only in pushing your particular agenda, then it is not safe. Because democracy requires that sometimes your side loses, that you don't get what you really want at the time that you want it. But you learn how to accept and go along with what the majority wants. And then if you don't like it, then you work towards changing that with the system that's there.
Within the system.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. What we're seeing is desperation among those who believe they're going to be the minority in this country. And that desperation is not surprising, nor is it new. I'm reminded of a book that was published in 1829 by David Walker called Walker's Appeal, in which he actually stated how he was talking both to black people and to white people. And he said, look, we've got an issue here in America. And white people, you're afraid that if black people get free, they're going to come and kill you because of the things that you've done. Black people, you're sick and tired of being held back for those who are enslaved, of being enslaved, abused, et cetera, et cetera. If you're free, not having access as everyone else has to your own labor in some cases, to the fruits of your hard work. And so he said, America, you've got something coming down the pipe. White people, if you just go ahead and leave black people alone and let them be free, all of this fear, all of this, what you consider to be revenge that'll be coming, it'll all be forgotten. Because people at the end of the day simply want to be left alone and live their lives. And he said, but if you keep on, there will be a race war. There will be an explosion. You will have a reason to fear. And he spoke to, he used the justification of his position by using the Constitution. He actually set the document up like the Constitution, and he cited the words of the Constitution saying this is the hope that is here. This is the rule of law. But one thing we have to remember in our society is that a lot of the racism that was introduced into the law really came from the published sermons of Puritan ministers like Cotton Mather, you know, who talked about how it is impossible for a black person to be a Christian because they're black. And you know, so he invokes the Hamitic myth, you know, well, black people are black because God made them that way. They violated God's ordinances. They were sinners. And therefore, in order to become a Christian, you have to become white. And but those were just some of the things that they said. And the justices and the judges took that rationale and put it into law. And so a lot of people don't realize that American legal history is very much connected to the religious history and the justifications for maintaining power among the elite.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about how historians of the future may talk about America at its 250th year of existence with historian Dr. Cassandra Newby Alexander and constitutional law scholar Dr. Vania Blakelock. 757-440-2665 or 1-800-940-2240 are the numbers to call to join our conversation. Anita joins us from Chesapeake. Hi, Anita. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call, and thank you for having this conversation today. As I would love that this was national radio, that everybody in America would be able to hear this conversation and be enlightened as to the effect of the Supreme Court in our lives going forward. As if they don't vote positively in this election, this administration could give us two more younger conservative, super conservative judges that would set this country back over 100 years.
Thank you so much for the call, Anita. We really appreciate that. Vania, you want to respond?
Yeah. I think I'll respond to that with answering your question about democracy, because my response is related. I would argue that at least democracy, as our Constitution has designed it, has always been precarious. Right. The Constitution is, some argue it's a contract where there are compromises. Right. Everyone had to make compromises, and there were compromises surrounding enslavement. Right. Like even how many representatives we get in the House is based on a compromise between the slave owning states and the non-slave owning states. Mm-hmm. And so I think the historian in me would say, at every moment of our history, and every 100 or so years, we have this crisis where we have to fight to see what kind of country we are going to be. On the other hand, what has been probably the most troubling from the current court that a lot of people aren't really talking about is how they are shifting the balance between the separation of powers. You know, almost all the cases that I was going to talk about today are Trump v. this, you know, Trump v. U.S., Trump v. Slaughter, Trump v. Barbara, Trump v. Hawaii. There's so many things that have been happening where the court has expanded presidential and executive power at the expense of decreasing congressional and legislative power and also expanding judicial authority. And I think for those of us who are concerned with democracy, and especially democracy as our Constitution has designed it, we should be concerned that even if we have democracy going forward, it may not look like the democracy we've always had based on that change in how the executive is functioning, how the judiciary is functioning, and how Congress is functioning. So that is just something to think about. And that does matter. Who's on the court matters. You know, I think I said this last time I was up here, you know, we only get Brown v. Board of Education because Chief Justice Vinson has a heart attack before they decided it the first time. So who's on the court really does matter. And until there are changes to how we appoint justices, that means who we elect as president really does matter.
So let me ask you a question then. Do you think the Founding Fathers ever planned for, since they apparently tried to plan for all of this checks and balances and so forth in our government, did they ever plan for the fact that there would be a court that would try to change the dynamics of the three branches?
Yeah, that's a complicated question. So I think I would say first thought is no. Most people, when they look at the judicial power, you know, when you start a constitutional law class and you want to talk about judicial authority, you always go to the Federalist Papers. And Federalist number 84, written by Alexander Hamilton, this is the argument he makes, is that the judiciary has no power. You know, people were concerned when they were trying to ratify the Constitution of this branch of government that was not elected, that serves life terms, and that was separate from the people. It looked like aristocracy, which is what the revolution was trying to reject, right? Mm-hmm. And so people were concerned. They didn't like how the judiciary was set up, and they didn't like that they had this power of judicial review. And so what Hamilton says famously is that they don't have the sword or the purse. Right. If anybody's going to be powerful, it's going to be the executive and Congress. You don't have to worry about the judiciary. That being said, the way the judiciary invalidated congressional legislation just was not at the scope that we have it today. It just wasn't. So I don't know that they thought that we would have a court that looks the way that our court does. And you have to remember, when starting out, people like Madison, they didn't even think that we would have political parties, right? And so the polarization of our court is a very different vision than how the founders would have thought. Throw into the fact that they didn't think that a third of the population would ever be participating in this democracy. That also changes things, right? It's a lot easier to come to compromise when everyone looks like you and everyone has the same interests as you. It's different when you become a multiracial democracy, as we've become.
Cassandra.
You know, I wholeheartedly agree. I think that that it was a gentleman's agreement. When you look at how Trump has pushed the boundaries and said, well, you know, there's no rule that says I can't do this. And then you have the Supreme Court allowing him to violate the law with impunity. And then you have opened the floodgates. It seems that every branch right now is open to corruption and has participated in a lot of corruption. Years ago, when I think about when General Grant was president, that was perhaps one of the first big situations where there was a lot of corruption, not so much with him, but with the people who were connected with him, people in his administration. And it was enough to create a huge financial crisis. it was enough to, you know, to overturn really a lot of support of the Republican Party at that time. And that continued to go on, you know, with parties kind of flipping back and forth, you know, mm-hmm. which one is going to out-corrupt the other. And that was actually the time that we began to see people who were part of the corporate world beginning to buy politicians versus the politicians themselves being really part of that corporate world, that that earlier corporate world. So America really needs to look at its Constitution and decide how the Constitution really needs to be set up. My theory is that we're probably going to move in a direction of a new Constitution, because this current Constitution is a gentleman's agreement, basically among elite white men. And in order for our Constitution to reflect the needs of the current population, it has to be between not just elite white men. It cannot be just an agreement where everyone is saying, I will follow these rules, even though there are no penalties if you violate those rules. I think that a new constitution has to be crafted to reflect that. And I know I'm stepping out there, you know, with shards of glass, you know, waiting for me. But I really, you know, in looking at the Constitution, you know, you have to put guardrails in there. You have to put requirements. If the Speaker of the House is essentially throwing up his or her hands and saying, well, whatever the president wants, you are in violation of the Constitution and you should be removed. There should be process A, B, C, D, you know, as opposed to this gentleman's agreement that you're supposed to do it.
Wow, that's a lot to unpack. Go ahead, Vania.
Yeah, no, I was going to say that I often think about this, because the last time we've kind of had this, every time we have a broken moment in American history, right, amendments come out of it, whether they are the Reconstruction Amendments after the Civil War, or enforcing the Reconstruction Amendments after the Civil Rights Movement. And I've been thinking about that a lot lately, which is, what is going to be the answer to this? Because there is going to be pushback. The pendulum always swings. And what does that look like? We don't have the kind of Congress that we had during Reconstruction. And perhaps that's what we need. I often think about the fact that the Reconstruction Congress did all this stuff against the president who rejected them. A lot of times, everything they passed was vetoed by President Johnson, and they just overturned that veto. There are guardrails in the Constitution. I think what has happened is that the guardrails that exist just are not being enforced. When I was on a panel on the birthright citizenship case after the oral arguments, I said, what would be great for this country is that this decision was a 9-0, because it was so straightforward, it was so to the point, and it would tell the American people that the court hasn't been infiltrated as much as we think it has. And so color me surprised when it was not even really 6-3. Exactly. And so I think what Dr. Alexander was saying is that we need stronger guardrails. Our guardrails don't exist anymore. The ones that did exist aren't being enforced.
So let me ask you ladies this then. What can or should everyday Americans be thinking about in terms of all of this? Because, you know, I'm concerned. One of my concerns is that the our community in particular, we're not passing down history like we used to. People don't seem to be as engaged in terms of what is actually happening around them. And until something very specific hits them, you know, it's one thing when you got to pay $4 for a gallon of gas, but the whole thought process before it even gets to that. People don't pay attention. So what do we, how can we make sure that one, that all of the history is told, and then two, that we're paying attention so that we can be active in whatever this next process is? Because if you're talking, Cassandra, about a new constitution and we don't have a say in it, then that's not going to be good.
Well, you know, a lot of, especially Black parents, they need to start showing up at school board meetings. Mm-hmm. I have been a long opponent of the standards of learning, and I saw the standards really, well, from the beginning, they were messed up, but especially under the Youngkin administration, they, instead of teaching civics, they were teaching patriotism. And I remember having a conversation with the then Secretary of Education, who told me it was the same thing. And I told her she was nuts. There's no similarity between patriotism, which is an emotional response, it versus civics, which is an intellectual understanding of what your responsibility is in the operation of government and how government operates. It's not enough that you love your country. That's patriotism, but that has nothing to do with what your responsibilities are and how government functions. And you talk with most young people who've been brought up under these standards of learning, and they are completely unaware of how government functions, of how they can change government. In fact, they see government as a consumer activity. Well, I voted and my candidate didn't win. Well, what's your point? That's part of voting, you know? So next time, maybe if you volunteer, if you advocate more, you will convince more people to go along with your point of view. Mm-hmm. But a lot of people don't really know. And then they have family members telling them not to vote. You've got podcasters telling Black people not to vote and giving all kinds of crazy rationales, none of which are true, none of which makes any sense. But it gives excuses to people to focus on the wrong thing, as opposed to what's really important, because how government functions can have a direct role in how safe you are, how contented you are as a resident of the area, and what kinds of amenities you might have or resources you may have for you and your family.
And it starts locally.
Yes.
Because people think on the, you know, want to think on a national scale all the time, but it starts here at home.
In fact, I remind my students all the time that you pay more in local taxes than in state or federal taxes. So you need to first start locally.
Vania, let me ask you this question, actually, for both of you guys. The Smithsonian is under attack.
Again.
Right now, again, where they are saying that the National American, the Museum of the National American Museum, yes, is not correct in the way that it tells stories. I thought it was a little ironic that the participants of the Freedom 250 found safety and shelter in the National African American Museum.
Is that a metaphor?
Some would say the universe has a sense of humor.
Yes. But I guess my question is, in terms of how things are going for the future, how critical is it that our institutions, that our historical institutions, our legal institutions are left alone in terms of doing the scholarly work that they're supposed to do, as opposed to getting caught up in the day-to-day media
work? Well, there is actually some pressure at some institutions. Uh-huh. In fact, when Trump first came into office, I noticed there was a strong tension for those of us who focus in on some aspect of African-American history. And I, being the big mouth that I am, basically said, nobody is going to tell me what I can and cannot research. And yeah. if we want to have a fight over this, I'm ready for the fight. Mm-hmm. And there were people who backed down. But there, you know, fear is a very dangerous thing. Fear can keep you staying in a building that's burning, as opposed yeah. to running out and saving your life. Mm-hmm. Fear can yeah. keep you from speaking up and standing strong. I think about what Jack Smith said. He said, I'm not afraid. And you yeah. shouldn't be either. Stand up for your rights. And every time we've seen people stand up for their rights and stand strong, they've won. But you still have a lot of people willing to capitulate.
Vinny,
yeah, my son, who's 6 years old, this summer, we're doing this Black History reading program. And we just recently read a book on John Lewis. And I remember having to explain to my six-year-old this kind of concept of good trouble and thinking to myself, the kind of courage that it takes, that doesn't come always naturally. Like, we have to explain to the younger generations that this kind of courage is worth it and that it also has consequences. My son was hung up on the fact that John Lewis was arrested so many times. Those are consequences, mm-hmm. but those are consequences that led to results. On the part about the pressure of our institutions, I will say, so I was recently on the job market, and I also published work at the Center of Race and Education and the Law, and I interviewed at a few schools that were, I won't say where they were, but that had pressure from their state schools, you know, they mm-hmm. had pressure from the legislatures to evaluate syllabi, evaluate faculty members. And I remember being told in a conversation kind of off the record that I could still do what I wanted to do, but I maybe would have to frame it a different way. And I was struck by that because those of us who are doing this work, who are doing particularly Black history, women's history, LGBT, mm-hmm. queer history, there is a lot of pressure right now, a lot of pressure to capitulate. And it is going to take courage. You know, I don't think of my job as an academic as being on the front lines by any means necessary, but there is pressure. And there is this question that you have to ask yourself. I had to ask myself, am I willing to sacrifice monetary status, you know, my job, mm-hmm. For things I believe in? And we all have to make that choice. And I think something that is really useful is leaning on our ancestors, leaning on the fact that there were people marching in the streets and people died for my right to vote. I'm always struck when I see online, like Dr. Alexander was saying, when there were podcasters, people telling Black Americans not to vote. And I'm like, people literally died for you to have that right. Like, that is exactly. not an exaggeration. They literally died. And people who I've known in my lifetime, my grandparents, did not come out of adulthood having the right to vote. I think just letting people know and starting early, like, I am having these conversations with my six-year-old. Some people might think that's crazy, but I want him to know that these are the legacies that you can stand on. These are the memories that can give you courage if you are faced with these same kind of challenges.
And how do you respond then to people who I'm sure you have had say to you, but if you teach them that, then you're just teaching them to be racist?
Yes, that's a great question. And I think people who say that, either they don't have kids or they don't know what it means to teach age appropriateness, but it has led to some sticky questions. So my son has, you know, been in spaces that are predominantly white, mm-hmm. and he's asked me, we've talked about desegregation a lot because that's what I do. And he's like, why did people think that way? Why did they do that? And honestly, this six-year-old says, that's just stupid. Like, you know, when I explain to him that they think that, you know, because someone has a different skin color, they're less than. He's like, that's just dumb. And I'm always clear to say, it's not all white people, right? Like, I'm not making, yeah. I'm not teaching him racism. But I think the idea that teaching the truth is teaching racism is a lie, a myth that we consistently have to fight. You don't become racist by learning the dangers of racism. Like, that doesn't make any sense. So I have heard that before. And I mean, he does probably think about race more than his friends who have never had to have those conversations. But I would rather him think about race and not be colorblind than to be in a situation where he goes to vacation with his friends and doesn't come back.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's a reality of what Black families have to deal with. We got 3 minutes left. I'm going to give each of you a minute and a half to encourage people to stay encouraged through this. I'll start with you, Vania.
I would just say that, you know, the thing is that there's always hope. If ever we survived a civil war, we survived, you know, the civil rights movement, we can keep fighting. That I always find my encouragement, like I said earlier, in looking at what my ancestors survived, and to know that no one has won. I used to have a pastor that used to say, all it takes for bad men to win is for good men to do nothing. And I think about that a lot, is that as long as we're not doing nothing, bad men can't win forever.
That is constitutional law scholar and Dr. Vania Blakelock. Thank you so much for joining us today. I do appreciate it so much. And Cassandra, you have the last word.
You know, I believe that my first words, rather than being mama or dada, was why. And I encourage people to use that simple three-letter word whenever they are confronted with the realities of what is happening. Ask the why. It's the why that gets you in good trouble. The why says, well, why can't I go into this building and enjoy the same amenities as everyone else? Why are you thinking that as we talk about the real history, that you're saying we're teaching racism? Perhaps you don't know what the word really means. Perhaps it's just a catchphrase that you're using as a way of pushing people away from the truth. So why? And I believe that the why is how you can become a good citizen. The why is how you can stay in good trouble, because the why will push the nation towards its promises, and hopefully will actually achieve the promise of America.
Dr. Cassandra Newby Alexander, as always, thank you so very much for being with us today. And audience, before we leave you, I do have a favor to ask. On July 30th, Dr. Keith Newby and Dr. Alvian Lyons continue their conversations on relationships. We want to know from you, what type of relationship would you like them to talk about? In June, we talked about marriage. What's next? Siblings, coworkers, parents, teens? Send us a note at contact@anotherviewradio.org so we can talk about what's most interesting to you. So please fill in to that for us. And also the live show, we are going to be live from the Rosenwald School in Virginia's Eastern Shore on August the 6th and on August 27th at Fort Monroe for a sneak peek of the new African Landing Memorial Statue. You can go to WHRO.org/events and register for both. So come on out and join us live for the show. Our theme music is an original composition created especially for Another View by Jay Sennett. Lisa Godley is our show producer. Jordan Christie is our audio engineer. And Dr. Barry Graham answered our phones. I'm Barbara Ham Lee. Thanks so much for listening. And let's get together again next Thursday at noon for Another View.
Support comes from Hampton Roads Community Foundation, carrying out your charitable wishes forever. Whether it's helping shelter animals, feeding the homeless, enhancing the arts, or supporting students. Learn more at leaveabequest.org.